So what if I told you that the $100 price tag on your next video game and a completely finished Hollywood movie that you are suddenly just not allowed to see, and that dusty Wi-Fi router sitting behind your couch right now are all actually being controlled by the exact same invisible economic force?
It sounds like a conspiracy theory,
Oh,
honestly.
right. But welcome to your custom deep dive. Today, we are pulling our source material directly from the June 22nd, 2026 edition of Tekken Knight.
Which is such a great read. For anyone who isn't familiar, Tekken Knight is this highly regarded late night industry digest.
Yeah, it really captures the stories that break when the rest of the world is basically asleep.
Exactly. Like before the morning PR teams can wake up and spin them. It's a fascinating publication because it completely strips away all the marketing language.
You just get the raw data.
Yeah, you're looking at the raw gears of the tech and entertainment industries turning in real time. And when you look at tonight's dispatches, this very clear, honestly slightly unsettling pattern starts to emerge about who actually holds power over the things we consume.
Okay, let's unpack this. Our mission today is to connect these seemingly random late-night stories because together they map out a massive shift in hidden economics. And I think we have to start with the most visible hit to the consumer's wallet, which is the literal price of admission to play a video game.
Oh, the GTA 6 leak,
Yeah.
yeah.
I'm looking at this leak from a Portuguese retailer called FNAC. They briefly listed the pricing for Rockstar's Grand Theft Auto 6. And the standard edition is sitting at around 90 euros.
Which converts to what, like 103 US dollars?
Right around there, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And if you want the collector's edition, we are looking at roughly $229.
Which is just wild. I mean, that $100 barrier for a base game is a monumental psychological threshold for buyers.
It really is.
The industry analyst Matt Piscitella is actually quoted in the digest calling this an economic experiment.
An experiment? Like, they don't even know if it'll work.
Pretty much. He points out that Rockstar Games is essentially using the sheer unavoidable cultural gravity of the GTA franchise to test if the global market will just, accept a totally new pricing reality.
But wait, 100 US dollars means something entirely different depending on where you live?
Yeah.
Like, if you're a gamer in a market like Brazil or Turkey, that price is astronomical. How could they even justify crossing that line?
Well, to understand why they're pushing that line, if we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to look at the hardware side of the equation.
Okay.
Specifically, what is happening with Sony and the PlayStation 5? It is a full-blown supply chain crisis right now.
Because usually consoles are relatively affordable, right?
Exactly. The traditional baseline model of the console industry going all the way back to the early days of gaming is the loss leader strategy. It's the razor and blades model.
Right, sell the razor cheap, make money on the blades.
Precisely. Sony historically took a heavy financial loss on every physical console they sold just to get that box into your living room.
Because once the box is under your TV, you kind of have to buy the games. And Sony takes a 30% cut of every game sold on their platform, so they make the real money on the software.
That was the math, yeah. But that math is fundamentally broken right now. The digest notes that the standard PS5 has spiked to $649,
Wow.
and the PS5 Pro is an eye-watering $899.
That is basically the price of a decent laptop.
It is, and it literally costs Sony over $600 just to manufacture a single standard console today.
Just to be, why is it so expensive all of a sudden?
It's because the specific components required to run modern games have just skyrocketed. The cost of GDDR6 memory, which is the specialized graphics memory that makes those massive 4K open worlds possible, that is up 60%.
60%.
Yeah. And Gen 4 NVMe SSDs, those ultra-fast storage drives that basically eliminated loading screens, those are up 45%.
So the parts are just way too expensive to subsidize anymore. But reading Sony's response here in the digest, I am genuinely confused.
Yeah.
Because hardware sales have plummeted 30% in recent months.
Right.
But instead of taking the financial hit to keep players in the ecosystem, they are choosing to just cut production volume. This feels like a restaurant deciding to.
Burn its own tables to save money on the tablecloths.
Yes, exactly. They are deliberately shrinking their own customer base.
How does that make any business sense if their whole model relies on a massive audience buying games?
Well, it doesn't, which is exactly why the $100 game is becoming a reality. Without that cheap hardware getting into tens of millions of living rooms, publishers have a much smaller audience to sell to.
Huh, I see.
Yeah, to recoup $1 billion development budget on a game like GTA 6, but with a shrinking install base, the price per player just has to go up. It's a vicious cycle that could force the PlayStation 6 to launch way earlier than planned, maybe 2028 or 2029. Or it might just push the entire industry to abandon physical boxes entirely and commit to cloud gaming.
That's a very real possibility.
It's wild to realize that global supply chain costs for, like, a memory chip are quietly dictating what games you can play and at what price.
Yeah, it's all connected.
But that idea of an industry quietly changing the rules of what you have access to, it's not just happening with the hardware you buy. It is infiltrating the streaming queues right in your living room. Have you been following this drama with Amazon MGM Studios and the new Luca Guadagnino film?
I have, yeah. It is a striking development in modern media consolidation. It's just a perfect example of corporate interests superseding creative output.
So here is the setup for you listening. There is a completed feature-length film called Artificial. It stars Andrew Garfield playing Sam Altman.
Which is phenomenal casting, by the way.
Totally. And it chronicles that incredibly chaotic 72-hour period back in November 2023 when Altman was suddenly fired and then rehired at OpenAI. The movie is fully shot, edited, and test audiences reportedly loved it.
And Amazon MGM just dropped it.
Shelved it completely. And the timing is just impossible to ignore. They dropped it just 4 months after Amazon signed a $50 billion strategic partnership with OpenAI.
The conflict of interest there is staggering.
Right. And the producers shopped the film around after Amazon dropped it, but the doors just slammed shut everywhere. Netflix passed, claiming it was too niche. Focus Features cited marketing budget concerns. A24 reportedly felt it was too close to ongoing business realities.
Which is a very telling phrase.
But hold on, if the movie is completely finished and paid for, why is a pass from Netflix or A24 a death sentence? Like, why can't the producers just put it on YouTube or a premium video on demand service to make their money back?
Well, because of the sheer scale of the investment. When you have an A-list director like Guadagnino and a huge star like Andrew Garfield, you are looking at a budget of tens of millions of dollars.
Okay, so you need a massive return.
Exactly. You simply cannot recoup that kind of capital through independent digital distribution. You need the marketing machine and the massive subscriber base of a major studio or streamer. Mubi is apparently suckling the project for a limited run, but the wide mainstream release that a film like this was built for is effectively dead.
There was an anonymous producer quoted in the Digest calling this a watershed moment, where corporate partnerships can actively veto storytelling. But let me challenge that for a second.
Sure.
Is this really a new phenomenon? Like, this is like your landlord forbidding you from reading a book about a plumber just because that plumber gives them a discount on pipe repairs.
Mm.
But old school Hollywood studios have always buried movies they thought would bomb or offend the general public, haven't they?
They have. Studio interference is as old as Hollywood itself. But the motivation here represents a fundamental shift.
How so?
Historical interference was almost always about box office appeal or, you know, avoiding a massive PR disaster with the actual ticket buyers. This situation with Artificial is what we can call strategic censorship.
Strategic censorship.
Right. It is based purely on B2B, business-to-business corporate relationships.
I see. So Amazon isn't worried that the audience won't like the movie?
Far from it. They were worried about upsetting a vendor they just invested $50 billion into.
Wow.
As tech giants like Apple and Amazon become the primary financiers of modern entertainment, this creates a profound chilling effect. Because they aren't just studios anymore, right? They are cloud computing providers, e-commerce empires, AI developers.
Right, they have their hands in everything.
Exactly. If a company can effectively bury a completed, high-quality film just to protect an enterprise software contract, then true editorial independence in Hollywood basically no longer exists.
That is bleak. But that kind of invisible corporate veto power, where a business relationship overrides your access to things, actually extends to the physical boxes powering your internet right now.
Oh, the router story. Yes.
Yeah, we are moving from a shelved movie to a massive cybersecurity discovery by Qianxin X Lab involving a piece of malware called Aerostinger.
This is one of those deeply technical stories that operates entirely in the background, but the implications for your home network are severe.
So Aerostinger has quietly infected over 4,300 legacy routers. Specifically, we're talking about older D-Link models like the DIR850L and 8118LW from that, like, 2012 to 2015 era. Basically, anything running a certain Realtek chip.
Which is a lot of devices.
It is. But what caught my eye is the behavior of the malware. This isn't a typical botnet. Usually when I read about botnets, they're used for DDoS attacks.
Right, hijacking thousands of devices to flood a target website with traffic until it crashes.
Exactly. But Aerostinger doesn't do that. It is a reconnaissance botnet. It just sits there, quietly scanning ports, fingerprinting services, and tunneling traffic without making a sound.
It is entirely focused on the pre-attack phase. They aren't trying to break the door down. They are quietly mapping out the structural weaknesses of the entire building.
To use an analogy, instead of a burglar throwing a brick through your window, this is like a burglar who has moved into your guest bedroom and is just spending years quietly sketching the floor plan of your entire neighborhood.
That is exactly what it's doing.
But I have to ask the obvious question here. Why? Why would a highly sophisticated hacker want access to a dusty 10-year-old router sitting behind someone's couch? Why not just rent a massive, cheap cloud server in another country to run these network scans?
Because of how enterprise security systems are designed to react.
Okay.
If a major corporation sees an aggressive network scam coming from a known data center IP address, their firewall immediately blocks it. It's a known threat vector. But if that exact same scan originates from a residential IP address, say, your grandmother's old D-Link router in Ohio, the firewall often waves it right through.
Oh, wow. Because it assumes it's just regular consumer traffic.
Exactly. Residential routers provide the perfect camouflage, and that camouflage requires intense operational discipline. These threat actors are playing a multi-year game.
And they can do that because these routers are so old.
Right. By compromising an end-of-life, or EOL, device, which is a router, the manufacturer has officially stated they will no longer support or update the hackers guarantee themselves a permanent foothold. They know D-Link is never going to release a security patch for a router manufactured in 2013.
The mitigation playbook in the digest is actually pretty brutal about this. If you have one of these infected routers, doing a factory reset is completely useless.
It really is. The malware just reinstalls itself.
Yeah. Total hardware replacement is the only actual fix.
Which brings up a massive policy dilemma that security researcher Bruce Schneier has been warning about for years. We have essentially built a global internet where significant portions of our infrastructure are permanently compromised due to planned obsolescence.
A scary thought.
It is. It forces us to ask, should manufacturers be legally required to provide security support for a minimum number of years? Or, if a device is officially end of life, should your internet service provider be required to automatically block it from the network to protect the broader ecosystem?
If you're listening to this right now, think about the router your ISP gave you 5 years ago.
Hmm.
Have you ever updated the firmware? Let's be real. Most people never touch it unless the Wi-Fi stops working.
No one does.
We are literally trusting the security of the global internet to whether or not consumers feel like buying a new router. So we have hackers exploiting outdated hardware to secretly map networks. Let's look at the software equivalent, how outdated code is being used to secretly map your digital finances.
Yes. This next story is straight out of the Bitcoin development community.
Yeah, this is a debate over a highly specific technical mechanism. But it reveals the immense difficulty of maintaining digital privacy on a public ledger. Let's get into the mechanics.
Yep.
Bitcoin Core developers are currently proposing the removal of a piece of code called the replace by fee, or RBF, signal.
Mm.
To explain how this used to work, back in the day, if the Bitcoin network was congested and your transaction was stuck pending, you could broadcast a new version of that transaction with a higher fee to speed it up.
Right, to kind of jump the line.
Exactly. But you had to explicitly opt in to this feature by including a specific signal in the code known as BIP-125.
It was a manual flag saying, you know, I might want to pay more to rush this later. But the network protocols evolved. In October 2024, the network upgraded so that full RBF became the default for every transaction.
So the ability to replace a fee was just universally applied.
Yes.
So that explicit opt-in signal became completely redundant. And here's where it gets really interesting. Because different Bitcoin wallet software processes that left over redundant code in slightly different ways, chain analysis firms, you know, the companies whose whole business model is tracking crypto transactions, they're using that leftover signal to fingerprint specific users.
It is such a clever exploit of old code.
It's like leaving your turn signal on for 50 miles on the highway. It doesn't help you drive. It just lets everyone tracking you know exactly who you are and what kind of car you're driving.
It's a metadata leak. Plain and simple.
But this is what I don't understand. If it is literally useless, redundant code that is actively hurting user privacy, why is there a debate? Why can't the developers just hit backspace, delete the BIP-125 signal, and push an update?
Because in foundational blockchain architecture, nothing exists in a vacuum. As Bitcoin Core developer Murch explained in the source material, this is a delicate, deeply interlocking system. The RBF signal isn't just an isolated line of text.
What is it then?
It is encoded directly into what are called transaction sequence numbers.
Okay, and what do those sequence numbers actually do?
They are heavily tied to time locks, and a time lock is basically a digital vault on the blockchain that dictates when certain funds can be spent. For example, it might say, this transaction cannot be processed until block 900,000. The sequence numbers govern the logic of those vaults. So if you just recklessly yank out the RBF signal, you risk fundamentally breaking the time lock functionality, which would severely damage complex smart contracts built on the protocol.
Ah, I see. It's like trying to remove a single thread from a very tight sweater, only to watch the entire sleeve unravel.
That's a perfect way to visualize it. And it really highlights why marginal privacy improvements require such agonizing technical gymnastics.
Yeah.
Bitcoin's ledger is completely public and permanent.
Right. It's there forever.
Exactly. Yeah. Every piece of metadata you leave behind is a liability forever. For journalists operating under repressive regimes or dissidents whose financial lives are being monitored by hostile governments, these seemingly minor technical fingerprints can be a matter of life and death.
Well, yeah.
Removing that signal makes it just a little bit harder for an authoritarian government to de-anonymize a user.
It really takes you back to the cypherpunk anti-establishment roots of cryptocurrency. Like, the whole point was creating a system outside of traditional government and corporate surveillance.
It was.
But to conclude tonight's deep dive, we are looking at a story that violently contrasts with those rebellious roots. We are seeing Bitcoin's absolute, undeniable integration into the heart of the automated Wall Street machine.
Yeah, this final development is the textbook definition of institutional capture. It shows how radical technologies are eventually absorbed and sanitized by the traditional financial system.
Let's look at the filing here. On June 18th, Franklin Templeton, which is a massive trillion-dollar asset manager, they filed for two new Bitcoin DRIP ETFs. These are the U.S. Equity and U.S. Innovation Funds.
And the portfolio makeup is what's so fascinating here.
Yeah, they are 95% traditional stocks and just 5% Bitcoin, with a hard cap ensuring Bitcoin never exceeds 20% of the fund. But the real mechanism here is the DRIP part, the dividend reinvestment plan.
This is the engine of the product. When the traditional blue chip stocks in that 95% bucket pay out their quarterly cash dividends, that cash isn't used to buy more stock. It is automatically, systematically converted into Bitcoin purchases.
So if I'm an investor in this fund, it essentially acts as a digital swear jar that passively stacks value in the background. Instead of sweeping up loose change, my traditional stock dividends are quietly buying fractions of Bitcoin while I sleep.
It creates an incredibly powerful dollar-cost averaging effect. It provides this constant automated bid for the asset, completely regardless of whether the price is up or down that day.
But I look at this setup and I wonder, doesn't this entirely ruin the original point of crypto?
How so?
Well, you are taking this decentralized anti-bank currency and wrapping it inside an SEC-regulated ETF run by a legacy asset manager sitting inside a standard brokerage account. It feels like Bitcoin has become the very thing it swore to destroy.
The irony is certainly thick, I'll give you that. Yep. Bitcoin was literally birthed in the direct aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis as a way to bypass traditional Wall Street bailouts.
Exactly.
Yet today, its biggest price drivers are not cyberpunk revolutionaries. They are hyper-regulated, tax-efficient institutional products managed by the very firms it sought to circumvent.
So why are they building it this way? Like, who is this actually for?
It caters perfectly to a massive demographic of traditional equity investors. They see the historical returns of Bitcoin and want exposure to the upside, but they want a set it and forget it mechanism.
They don't want the hassle.
Right. They have zero interest in the anxiety of managing private cryptographic keys, writing down seed phrases on a piece of paper, or worrying about getting hacked. They want their familiar dividend yield to systematically build a crypto position over time, entirely within a legally protected framework.
It makes sense when you put it like that.
Yeah, this fundamentally shifts the Bitcoin market from momentum-based, volatile retail speculation to a structural, persistent, systematic bid driven by Wall Street algorithms.
So what does this all mean? If we pull these seemingly disconnected late-night dispatches together, tonight's deep dive has really revolved around hidden mechanisms dictating our daily lives.
Absolutely.
We've explored the hidden supply chain costs of memory chips that are fundamentally breaking the loss leader business model of video games. We've unpacked the hidden business-to-business alliances that allow a tech giant to silently censor Hollywood storytelling.
Don't forget the routers.
Right. We mapped out the hidden hackers patiently exploiting residential internet routers to bypass enterprise firewalls. And finally, we looked at the hidden automated dividend mechanisms making Bitcoin a permanent, sanitized fixture in traditional finance.
If there is one overarching concept that ties all of this together for you listening, it is the idea of invisible ownership. Think about the landscape we've just mapped out for 2026. You might pay over $100 for a digital game that you don't truly own because economics force the industry away from physical media.
Right.
You might be denied the ability to watch a fully finished film because a massive corporation won't allow it to exist on their servers. You might have a physical piece of hardware in your home that actively belongs to a foreign reconnaissance network.
Which is terrifying.
Right. Or you might own a digital asset that was meant to be entirely decentralized, but Wall Street is quietly managing the keys for you.
It's a fundamental loss of agency.
Yeah.
And it is happening entirely behind the scenes while we sleep.
Exactly. And so the ultimate question you have to ask yourself is this. In this hyper-connected, deeply consolidated future, how much of your digital life do you actually control?
That is a heavy, essential question to leave you with. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, keep questioning those systems running quietly in the background of your home and your finances, and remember, just because something is happening out of sight middle of the night doesn't mean it won't impact you in the morning. Catch you next time.